From PRI, Public Radio International.
Easter is a party for to eat of the lamb, the Italian nanny explained. One, too, may eat of the chocolate. And who brings the chocolate? The teacher asked. I knew the word, so I raised my hand, saying, the rabbit of Easter. He bring of the chocolate.
You're listening to Tim Blake Nelson reading from David Sedaris' Jesus Shaves, which you'll be hearing later on today's edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Ever since President Nixon's downfall after the Watergate affair, the lesson has been learned that it's not the crime itself, it's the cover-up. Even in private life, it is often the case that we suffer for our mistakes, but suffer much more from our botched efforts to explain them away. This edition of Selected Shorts offers four stories in which elaborate explanations only make things worse. We start with a piece by Dorothy Parker, the doyenne of the Algonquin Round Table of New York Literary Wits and writer for Vogue, Vanity Fair, and The New Yorker. The piece is called Just a Little One, and it is read by the award-winning Broadway actress who most perfectly embodies the saucy wit of Ms. Parker, the inestimable Dana Ivey.
I like this place, Fred. This is a nice place. How did you ever find it? I think you're perfectly marvelous, discovering a speakeasy in the year 1928, and they let you right in without asking you a single question. I bet you could get into the subway without using anybody's name, couldn't you, Fred? Oh, I like this place better and better now that my eyes are getting accustomed to it. You mustn't let them tell you this lighting is original with them, Fred. They got the idea from the Mammoth Cave. This is you sitting next to me, isn't it? Oh, you can't fool me. I know that knee anywhere. You know what I like about this place? It's got atmosphere. That's what it's got. If you would ask the waiter to bring a fairly sharp knife, I could cut off a nice little block of the atmosphere to take home with me. It would be interesting to have for my memory book. I'm going to start keeping a memory book tomorrow. Don't let me forget. Why, I don't know, Fred. What are you going to have? Then I guess I'll have a highball, too. Please, just a little one. Is it really real scotch? Well, that will be a new experience for me. You ought to see the scotch I've got home in my cupboard. At least it was in the cupboard this morning. It's probably eaten its way out by now. I got it for my birthday. Well, it was something. The birthday before, all I got was a year older. This is a nice highball, isn't it? Well, 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 to think of me having real scotch. I'm out of the bush leagues at last. Are you going to have another one? Well, I shouldn't like to see you drinking all by yourself, Fred. Solitary drinking is what causes half the crime in the country. That's what's responsible for the failure of prohibition. But please, Fred, tell him to make mine just a little one. Make it awfully weak. Just cambric scotch. It will be nice to see the effect of veritable whiskey upon one who has been accustomed only to the simpler forms of entertainment. You'll like that, Fred. You'll stay by me if anything happens, won't you? I don't think there will be anything spectacular, but I want to ask you one thing, just in case. Don't let me take any horses home with me. It doesn't matter so much about stray dogs and kittens, but elevator boys get awfully stuffy when you try to bring in a horse. You might just as well know that about me now, Fred. You can always tell that the crash is coming when I start getting tender about our dumb friends. Three highballs, and I think I'm St. Francis of Assisi. But I don't believe anything is going to happen to me on these. That's because they're made of real stuff. That's what the difference is. This just makes you feel fine. Oh, I feel swell, Fred. You do too, don't you? I knew you did because you look better. I love that tie you have on. Oh, did Edith give it to you? Ah, wasn't that nice of her? You know, Fred, most people are really awfully nice. There are darn few that aren't pretty fine at heart. You've got a beautiful heart, Fred. You'd be the first person I'd go to if I were in trouble. I guess you are just about the best friend I've got in the world. But I worry about you, Fred. I do so, too. I don't think you take enough care of yourself. You ought to take care of yourself for your friend's sake. You oughtn't to drink all this terrible stuff that's around. You owe it to your friends to be careful. You don't mind my talking to you like this, do you? You see, dear, it's because I'm your friend that I hate to see you not taking care of yourself. It hurts me to see you batting around the way you've been doing. You ought to stick to this place where they have real scotch that can't do you any harm. Oh, darling, do you really think I ought to? Well, you tell him just a little bit of one. Tell him, sweet. Do you come here often, Fred? I shouldn't worry about you so much if I knew you were in a safe place like this. Oh, is this where you were Thursday night? I see. Why, no, it didn't make a bit of difference, only you told me to call you up, and like a fool, I broke a date I had, just because I thought I was going to see you. I just sort of naturally thought so when you said to call up. Oh, good Lord, don't make all that fuss about it. It really didn't make the slightest difference. It just didn't seem a very friendly way to behave, that's all. I don't know, I'd been believing we were such good friends. I'm an awful idiot about people, Fred. There aren't many who are really your friend at heart. Practically anybody would play you dirt for a nickel. Oh, yes, they would. Was Edith here with you Thursday night? This place must be very becoming to her. Next to being in a coal mine, I can't think of anywhere she could go that the light would be more flattering to that pan of hers. Do you really know a lot of people that say she's good looking? You must have a wide acquaintance among the astigmatic, haven't you, Freddie? Being any way at all, it's simply one of those things. Either you see it or you can't. Now, to me, Edith looks like something that would eat her young. Dresses well? Edith dresses well? Are you trying to kid me, Fred, at my age? You mean it? Oh, my God, you mean those clothes of hers are intentional? My heavens, I always thought she was on her way out of a burning building. Well, we live and learn. Edith dresses well. Edith's got good taste. Yes, she's got sweet taste in neckties. I don't suppose I ought to say it about such a dear friend of yours, Fred, but she is the lousiest necktie picker out I ever saw. I never saw anything could touch that thing you have around your neck. All right, suppose I did say I liked it. I just said that because I felt sorry for you. I'd feel sorry for anybody with a thing like that on. I just wanted to try to make you feel good because I thought you were my friend. My friend. I haven't got a friend in the world. Do you know that, Fred? Not one single friend in this world. All right. What do you care if I'm crying? I can cry if I want to, can't I? I guess you'd cry, too, if you didn't have a friend in the world. Is my face very bad? I suppose that damned mascara has run all over it. I've got to give up using mascara, Fred. Life's too sad. Isn't life terrible? Oh, my God, isn't life awful? Oh, don't cry, Fred. Please don't. Don't you care, baby. Life's terrible, but don't you care. You've got friends. I'm the one that hasn't got any friends. I am so. No, it's me. I'm the one. I don't think another drink would make me feel any better. I don't know whether I want to feel any better. What's the sense of feeling good when life's so terrible? Oh, all right then. But please tell him, just a little one, if it isn't too much trouble. I don't want to stay here much longer. I don't like this place. It's all dark and stuffy. It's the kind of place Edith would be crazy about. That's all I can say about this place. Well, I know I oughtn't to talk about your best friend, Fred, but that's a terrible woman. That woman is the louse of this world. Makes me feel just awful that you trust that woman, Fred. I hate to see anybody play you dirt. I'd hate to see you get hurt. That's what makes me feel so terrible. That's why I'm getting mascara all over my face. No, please don't, Fred. You mustn't hold my hand. That wouldn't be fair to Edith. We've got to play fair with the big louse. After all, she's your best friend, isn't she? Honestly? Do you honestly mean it, Fred? Yes, but how could I help thinking so when you're with her all the time? When you bring her here every night in the week? Really? Only Thursday? Oh, I know. I know how those things are. You simply can't help it when you get stuck with a person that way. Lord, I'm glad you realize what an awful thing that woman is. I was worried about it, Fred. It's because I'm your friend. Why, of course I am, darling. You know I am. Oh, that's just silly, Freddie. You've got heaps of friends. Only you'll never find a better friend than I am. No. I know that. I know I'll never find a better friend than you are to me. Just give me back my hand a second till I get this damn mascara out of my eye. Yes, I think we ought to, honey. I think we ought to have a little drink on account of our being friends. Just a little one, because it's real scotch and we're real friends. After all, friends are the greatest thing in the world, aren't they, Fred? Gee, it makes you feel good to know you have a friend. I feel great. Don't you, dear? And you look great, too. I'm proud to have you for a friend. Do you realize, Fred, what a rare thing a friend is when you think of all the terrible people there are in this world? Animals are much better than people. God, I love animals. That's what I like about you, Fred. You're so fond of animals. Look, I'll tell you what let's do. After we've had just a little highball, let's go out and pick up a lot of stray dogs. I never had enough dogs in my life, did you? We ought to have more dogs. And maybe there'd be some cats around if we looked. And a horse. I've never had one single horse, Fred. Isn't that rotten? Not one single horse. I'd like a nice old cab horse, Fred. Wouldn't you? I'd like to take care of it and comb its hair and everything. Oh, don't be stuffy about it, Fred. Please don't. I need a horse. Honestly, I do. Wouldn't you like one? It would be so sweet and kind. Let's have a drink, and then let's you and I go out and get a horsey, Freddy. Just a little one, darling. Just a little one.
Just a Little One by Dorothy Parker, read for us by Dana Ivey. The author of our next story, The Spray, is Jonathan Lethem, who wrote the novel Motherless Brooklyn, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award, and his new novel is called Chronic City. He brings to this short story the same antic imagination and sardonic sense of humor that characterize his novels. Our reader was Robert Sean Leonard, the award-winning New York stage actor who also spends a lot of time doing television drama on the West Coast. He was glad to be back reading literature on the West Side.
The apartment was burgled and the police came. Four of them and a dog. The three youngest were like boys. They wore buzzing, squawking radios on their belts. The oldest was in charge, and the young ones did what he told them. The dog sat. They asked what was taken, and we said we weren't sure, the television and the fax machine at least. One of them was writing, taking down what we said. He had a tick, an eye that kept blinking. What else? The oldest policeman asked. We didn't know what else. That's when they brought it out. A small, unmarked canister, and began spraying around the house. First, they put a mask over the mouth and nose of the dog. None of them wore a mask. They didn't offer us any protection, just the dog. Stand back, they said. They sprayed in a circle toward the edges of the room. We stood clustered with the policemen. What's that? We asked. Spray, said the oldest policeman. Makes lost things visible. The spray settled like a small rain through the house, and afterward, glowing in various spots, were the things the burglar had taken. It was a salmon-colored glow. On the table was a salmon-colored image of a box, a jewelry box that Addie's mother had given us. There was a salmon-colored glowing television and fax machine in place of the missing ones. On the shelves, the spray showed a Walkman and a camera and a pair of cufflinks, salmon-colored and luminous. In the bedroom was Addie's vibrator, glowing like a fuel rod. We all walked around the apartment, looking for things. The iTick policeman wrote down the names of the items that appeared. Addie called the vibrator a massager. The dog in the mask, eyes watering. I couldn't smell the spray. How long does it last? We said. About a day, said the policeman who'd done the spraying, not the oldest. You know you can't use this stuff anymore, even though you can see it, he said. It's gone. Try and touch it, said the oldest policeman. He pointed at the glowing jewelry box. We did, and it wasn't there. Our hands passed through the visible missing objects. They asked us about our neighbors. We told them we trusted everyone in the building. They looked at the fire escape. The dog sneezed. They took some pictures. The burglars had come through the window. Addie put a book on the bedside table on top of the glowing vibrator. It showed through like it was projected onto the book. We asked if they wanted to dust for fingerprints. The older policeman shook his head. They wore gloves, he said. How do you know? We said. Rubber gloves leave residue, powder, he said. That's what makes the dog sneeze. Oh. They took more pictures. Did you want something to drink? The older one said no. One of the younger policemen said, I'm allergic, just like the dog. And the other policeman laughed. Addie had a drink, a martini. The policemen shook our hands, and then they went away. We'd been given a case number. The box and the cufflinks and the rest still glowed. Then Addie saw that the policeman had left the spray. She took the canister, said, there was something wrong with those policemen. You mean how young they seemed? No, I think they always look young. You just don't notice on the street. Outdoors, you see the uniforms, but in the house, you can see they're just barely old enough to vote. What are you going to do with that? I said. She handled it. Nothing. Didn't you think there was something strange about those policemen, though? You mean the one with the lisp? He didn't have a lisp. He had a twitchy eye. Well, there was the one with an eye thing, but the one who stuttered. Is that what you mean by strange? Addie kept turning the canister over in her hands. Why don't you let me take that? I said. It's okay, she said. I guess I don't know what I mean. Just something about them. Maybe there were too many of them. Do you think they develop the pictures themselves, Aaron? Do you think they have a dark room in the police station? I said, probably. She said, do you think the missing things show up in the photographs? The things the spray reveals? Let's just keep it and see if they come back. I wish you would put it on the table. Well, let's find a place to hide it. They're probably doing some kind of inventory right now at the police station. They'll probably be back for it any minute. So, if we hide it, we look guiltier than if we just put it on the table. We didn't steal anything. Our house was broken into. They left it here. I wish you would put it on the table. I wonder if the police do their inventory by spraying around the police station to see what's missing. So, if we have their spray, they'll never know what happened. She shrieked with laughter. I laughed too. I moved next to her on the couch, and we rolled and laughed like monkeys in a zoo. Still laughing, I put my hand on the spray canister. Gimme, I said. Let go. Her laughter faded as she pulled at the can. The ends of several hairs were stuck to her tongue. I pulled on the can, and she pulled. We both pulled harder. Gimme, I said. I let go of the can and tickled her. Gimme, gimme, gimme. She grimaced and twisted away from me. Not funny, she said. The police don't have their spray, I said, and kept tickling her. Not funny, not funny. Slapping my hands away, she stood up. Okay, you're right. It's not funny. Put it on the table. No, let's return it, like you said. I'm too tired. Let's just hide it. We can return it tomorrow. Okay. I'll hide it. Cover your eyes. Not hide and seek. We have to agree on a place, a locked place. What's the big deal? Let's just leave it on the table. She put it on the table beside the salmon-colored glowing box. Maybe somebody will break in and take it. Maybe the police will break in. You're a little mixed up, I said. I moved closer to the table. I'm just tired, she pretended to yawn. What a day. I don't miss the stuff that was taken, I said. You don't? I hate television and faxes. I hate this little jewelry box. See if you're still saying that tomorrow when you can't see them anymore. I only care about you, you. I grabbed the canister of spray. She grabbed it too. Let go, she said. You're all I love. You're all that matters to me, I said. We wrestled for the can again. We fell onto the couch together. Let's just put it down on the table, said Addie. Okay. Let go. You first. No, at the same time. We put it on the table. are you thinking what I'm thinking? She said. I don't know, probably. What are you thinking? I'm not thinking anything. Well, then I'm not either. Liar. It probably doesn't work that way, I said. The police wouldn't have a thing like that. It isn't the same thing. So why not try? Don't. Well, you said it wouldn't work. Just don't. It's toxic. You saw them cover the dog's mouth. They didn't cover themselves. Anyway, I asked them about when you were in the other room. They said it was so you wouldn't see the stuff the dog ate that fell out of its mouth, because the dog is a sloppy eater. So the spray would show what it had been eating recently around the mouth. It's disgusting, they said. Well, now you're the liar. Let's just see. I jumped up. If you spray me, I'll spray you, I shouted. The spray hit me as I moved across the room. The wet mist fell behind me like a parachute, collapsing in the spot where I'd been, but enough got on me. An image of Lucinda formed, glowing and salmon-colored. Lucinda was naked. Her hair was short, like when we were together. Her head lay on my shoulder, her arms were around my neck, and her body was across my front, my shirt and jacket. Her breasts were mashed against me, but I couldn't feel them. Her knee was across my legs. I jumped backwards, but she came with me, radiant and insubstantial. I turned my head to see her face. Her expression was peaceful, but her little salmon-colored eyelids were half open. Ha, said Addie. I told you it would work. Give me that, I lunged for the spray. Addie ducked. I grabbed her arm and pulled her with me onto the couch. Me and Addie and Lucinda were all there together, Lucinda placidly naked. As Addie and I wrestled for the spray, we plunged through Lucinda's glowing body, her luminous arms and legs. I got my hands on the spray canister. We both had our hands on it, four hands covering the one can. Then it went off. One of us pressed the novel. I don't know who. It wasn't Lucinda, anyway. As the spray settled over us, Charles became visible. Poised over Addie, he was naked like Lucinda. His glowing shoulders and legs and ass were covered with glowing salmon hair, like the halo around a light bulb. His mouth was open. His face was blurred, like he was a picture someone had taken while he was moving his face, saying something. There you go, I said. You got what you wanted. I didn't want anything, said Addie. We put the spray on the table. How long did the police say it would last? I asked. I tried not to look at Lucinda. She was right beside my head. About 24 hours. What time is it? It's late. I'm tired. The police didn't say 24 hours. About a day, they said. That's 24 hours. Well, probably they meant it's gone the next day. I don't think so. I looked at the television. I looked at the cufflinks. I looked at Charles's ass. Probably the sunlight makes it wear off, I said. Maybe. Probably you can't see it in the dark, in complete darkness. Let's just go to bed. We went into the bedroom, all four of us. I took off my shoes and socks. Probably it's just attached to my clothes. If I take my clothes off and leave them in the other room, try it. I took off my pants and jacket. Lucinda was attached to me, not the clothes. Her bare salmon knee was across my bare legs. I started to take off my shirt. Addie looked at me. Lucinda's face was on my bare shoulder. Put your clothes back on, said Addie. I put them back on. Addie left her clothes on. We lay there on top of the covers in our clothes. Lucinda and Charles were on top of us. I didn't know where to put my hands. I wondered how Addie felt about Charles's blurred face, his open mouth. I was glad Lucinda wasn't blurred. Turn off the light, I said. We won't be able to see them in the dark. Addie turned off the light. The room was dark. Charles and Lucinda glowed salmon above us, glowing in the darkness with the vibrator on the side table and the luminous dial on my watch. Just close your eyes, I said to Addie. You close yours first, she said.
Robert Sean Leonard read The Spray by Jonathan Lethem. After a quick break, we'll be back with a story read by Parker Posey. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. This program's third reader making her Selected Shorts debut is Parker Posey, an actress best known for her roles in Christopher Guest's mockumentaries, such as Best in Show and A Mighty Wind. Appropriately enough, her assignment on stage at Symphony Space was to read a work by the filmmaker, writer, and performing artist Miranda July. Her story, which you'll hear now in the voice of Parker Posey, is called The Swim Team.
This is the story I wouldn't tell you when I was your girlfriend. You kept asking, and your guesses were so lurid and specific. Was I a kept woman? Was Belvedere like Nevada, where prostitution is legal? Was I naked the entire year? The reality began to seem barren. And in time, I realized that if the truth felt empty, then I would probably not be your girlfriend much longer. I had wanted to live in Belvedere, but I couldn't bear to ask my parents for money to move. Every morning, I was shocked to remember I lived alone in this town that wasn't even a town. It was so small. It was just houses near a gas station. And then about a mile down, there was a store, and that was it. Yeah, I didn't have a car. I didn't have a phone. I was 22, and I wrote my parents every week and told them stories about working for a program called READ. We read to at-risk youth. It was a state-funded pilot program. I never decided what the letters READ stood for, but every time I wrote pilot program, I kind of marveled at my ability to come up with such phrases. Early intervention was another good one. This story won't be very long because the amazing thing about that year was that almost nothing happened. The citizens of Belvedere thought my name was Maria. I never said it was Maria, but somehow this got started, and I was overwhelmed by the task of telling all three people my real name. These three people were named Elizabeth Kelda and Jack Jack. I don't know why Jack twice, and I'm not completely sure about the name Kelda, but that's what it sounded like, and that's the sound I made when I called her name. I knew these people because I gave them swimming lessons. This is the real meat of my story because, of course, there are no bodies of water near Belvedere and no pools. And they were talking about this in the store one day, and Jack Jack, who must be dead by now because he was really old, said it didn't matter anyways because he and Kelda couldn't swim, so they'd be liable to drown themselves. Elizabeth was Kelda's cousin, I think, and Kelda was Jack Jack's wife. They were all in their 80s, at least. Elizabeth said that she had swum many times one summer as a girl while visiting a cousin, obviously not cousin Kelda. The only reason I joined the conversation was that Elizabeth said you had to breathe underwater to swim. That's not true, I yelled. These were the first words I'd spoken out loud in weeks. My heart was pounding like I was asking someone out on a date. You just hold your breath. Elizabeth looked angry and then said that she'd been kidding. And Kelda said she'd be too scared to hold her breath because she had an uncle who died from holding his breath too long in a hold your breath contest. And Jack-Jack asked if she actually believed this, and Kelda said, yes, I do. And Jack-Jack said, your uncle died of a stroke. I don't know where you get these stories from, Kelda. And then we all stood there for a while in silence. I was really enjoying the companionship and hoped it would continue. Which it did, because Jack-Jack said, so you've swum. I told them about how I'd been on a swim team in high school and even competed at the state level, but had been defeated early on by Bishop O'Dowd, a Catholic school. I hadn't even thought of it as a story before this, but now I could see that it was actually a very exciting story, full of drama and chlorine and other things that Elizabeth and Kelda and Jack-Jack didn't have first-hand knowledge of. It was Kelda who said she wished there was a pool in Belvedere because they were obviously very lucky to have a swim coach living in town. I hadn't said I was a swim coach, but I knew what she meant. That it was a shame. And then a strange thing happened. I was looking down at my shoes on the brown linoleum floor, and I was thinking about how I bet this floor hadn't been washed in a million years, and I suddenly felt like I was going to die. But instead of dying, I said, I can teach you how to swim, and we don't need a pool. We met twice a week in my apartment. When they arrived, I had three bowls of warm tap water lined up on the floor, and then a fourth bowl in front of those, the coach's bowl. I added salt to the water because it's supposed to be healthy to snort warm salt water, and I figured they'd be snorting accidentally. And I showed them how to put their noses and mouths in the water and how to take a breath to the side. And we added the legs and then the arms. I admitted these were not perfect conditions for learning to swim. But I pointed out this was how Olympic swimmers trained when there wasn't a pool nearby. Yes, this was a lie. But we needed it because we were four people lying on the kitchen floor, kicking it loudly as if angry, as if furious, as if disappointed and frustrated and not afraid to show it. The connection to swimming had to be enforced with strong words. It took Kelda several weeks to learn how to put her face in the water. That's okay, I said. We'll start you out with a kickboard. I handed her a book. That's totally normal to resist the bowl, Kelda. It's the body telling you it doesn't want to die. It doesn't, she said. I taught them all the strokes I knew. The butterfly was just incredible. Like nothing you've ever seen. I thought the kitchen floor would give in and turn liquid, and away they would go with Jack-Jack in the lead. Yeah, he was precocious, to say the least. He actually moved across the floor, bowl of salt water and all. Yeah. He'd come pounding back into the kitchen from a bedroom lap, covered with sweat and dust, and Kelda would look up at him, holding her book in both hands and just beam. Swim to me, he'd say. But she was too scared. And it actually takes a huge amount of upper body strength to swim on land. I was the kind of coach who stands by the side of the pool instead of getting in, but I was busy every moment. If I can say this without being immodest, I was instead of the water. I kept everything going. I was talking constantly like an aerobics instructor, and I blew the whistle in exact intervals, marking off the sides of the pool. They would spin around in unison and go the other way. When Elizabeth forgot to use her arms, I'd call out, "Elizabeth, your feet are up, but your head is going down." And she'd madly start stroking, you know, quickly leveling out. With my meticulous hands-on coaching method, all dives began with perfect form, poised on my desktop, and ended in a belly flop onto the bed. But that was just for safety. It was still diving. It was still letting go of mammalian pride and embracing gravity. Elizabeth added a rule that we all had to make a noise when we fell. This was a little creative for my taste, but I was open to innovation. I wanted to be the kind of teacher who learned from her students. Kelda would make the sound of a tree falling if that tree were female. Elizabeth would make spontaneous noises that always sounded exactly the same. And Jack-Jack would say, "Bombs away!" At the end of the lesson, we would all towel off, and Jack-Jack would shake my hand, and either Kelda or Elizabeth would leave me with a warm dish, like a casserole or spaghetti. This was the exchange, and it made it so that I didn't really have to get another job. It was just 2 hours a week, but all the other hours were in support of those two. On Tuesday and Thursday mornings, I'd wake up and think, swim practice. Yeah. On the other mornings, I'd wake up and think, no swim practice. When I saw one of my students around town, say at the gas station or the store, I'd say something like, "Have you been practicing that needle nosedive?" And they would respond, "I'm working on it, coach." I know it's hard for you to imagine me as someone called coach. I had a very different identity in Belvedere. That's why it's so difficult to talk about it with you. I never had a boyfriend there. I didn't make art. I wasn't artistic at all. I was kind of a jock. I was totally a jock. I was the coach of a swim team. If I thought this would be at all interesting to you, I would have told you earlier, and maybe we would still be going out. It's been about 3 hours since I ran into you at the bookstore with that woman in the white coat. What a fabulous white coat. You are obviously completely happy and fulfilled already, even though we only broke up 2 weeks ago. I wasn't even totally sure we were broken up until I saw you with her. You seem incredibly far away to me, like someone on the other side of a lake, a dot so small that it isn't male or female or young or old. It is just smiling. Who I miss now tonight is Elizabeth, Kelda, and Jack-Jack. They are dead, of this I can be sure. What a tremendously sad feeling. I must be the saddest swim coach in all of history.
Miranda July's The Swim Team, read by Parker Posey. Our final tale is by that very funny guy, David Sedaris, whose original radio pieces are often heard on public radio on This American Life. His best-selling personal essay collections sport such engaging titles as Naked, Me Talk Pretty One Day, Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim, and funniest of all, When You Are Engulfed in Flames. The title of the Sedaris riff you're about to hear is Jesus Shaves, and if this assertion contradicts all those pictures you've seen in churches, well, David will explain why he chose it. Our reader, who was determined in our rehearsal not to do a David Sedaris imitation, but to find his own voice for this profound and comical essay, is the writer, film director, and film actor, and accomplished Shakespearean, Tim Blake Nelson.
And what does one do on the 14th of July? Does one celebrate Bastille Day? It was my second month of French class, and the teacher was leading us in an exercise designed to promote the use of one, our latest personal pronoun. Might one sing on Bastille Day? She asked. Might one dance in the streets? Somebody give me an answer. Printed in our textbooks was a list of major holidays accompanied by a scattered arrangement of photographs depicting French people in the act of celebration. The object of the lesson was to match the holiday with the corresponding picture. It was simple enough, but seemed an exercise better suited to the use of the pronoun they. I didn't know about the rest of the class, but when Bastille Day eventually rolled around, I planned to stay home and clean my oven. Normally, when working from the book, it was my habit to tune out my fellow students and scout ahead, concentrating on the question I'd calculated might fall to me. But this afternoon, we were veering from the usual format. Questions were answered on a volunteer basis, and I was able to sit back and relax, confident that the same few students would do most of the talking. Today's discussion was dominated by an Italian nanny, two chatty Poles, and a pouty, plump Moroccan woman who had grown up speaking French and had enrolled in the class hoping to improve her spelling. She'd covered these lessons back in the third grade and took every opportunity to demonstrate her superiority. A question would be asked, and she'd race to give the answer, behaving as though this were a game show, and if quick enough, she might go home with a tropical vacation or a side-by-side refrigerator freezer. A transfer student, by the end of her first day, she had raised her hand so many times that her shoulder had given out. Now she just leaned back and shouted out the answers, her bronzed arms folded across her chest like some great grammar genie. We had finished discussing Bastille Day, and the teacher had moved on to Easter, which was represented in our textbooks by a black and white photograph of a chocolate bell lying upon a bed of palm fronds. And what does one do on Easter? She asked. Would anyone like to tell us? The Italian nanny was attempting to answer when the Moroccan student interrupted, shouting, "Excuse me, but what's an Easter?" It would seem that despite having grown up in a Muslim country, she would have heard it mentioned once or twice, but no. "I mean it," she said. "I have no idea what you people are talking about." Our teacher then called upon the rest of us to explain. The Poles led the charge to the best of their ability. "It is," said one, "a party for the little boy of God who call himself Jesus," and she faltered, and her fellow countryman came to her aid. "He call himself Jesus, and then he die one day on two morsels of lumber." The rest of the class jumped in, offering bits of information that would have given the Pope an aneurysm. He die one day, and then he go above of my head to live with your father. He weared of himself the long hair, and after he die, the first day he come back here for to say hello to the peoples. He nice, the Jesus. He make the good things, and on the Easter we be sad, because somebody makes him dead today. Part of the problem had to do with vocabulary. Simple nouns such as cross and resurrection were beyond our grasp, let alone such complicated reflexive phrases such as to give of yourself your only begotten son. Faced with the challenge of explaining the cornerstone of Christianity, we did what any self-respecting group of people might do. We talked about food instead. Easter is a party for to eat of the lamb, the Italian nanny explained. One, too, may eat of the chocolate. And who brings the chocolate? The teacher asked. I knew the word, so I raised my hand, saying, the rabbit of Easter. He bring of the chocolate. A rabbit? The teacher, assuming I'd used the wrong word, positioned her index fingers on top of her head, wriggling them as though they were ears. You mean one of these? A rabbit? Well, sure, I said. He come in the night when one sleep on a bed. With a hand, he have a basket and foods. The teacher sighed and shook her head. As far as she was concerned, I had just explained everything that was wrong with my country. No, she said. Here in France, the chocolate is brought by a big bell that flies in from Rome. I called for a timeout. But how do the bell know where you live? Well, she said, how does a rabbit? It was a decent point, but at least a rabbit has eyes. That's a start. Rabbits move from place to place, while most bells can only go back and forth. And they can't even do that on their own power. On top of that, the Easter Bunny has character. He's someone you'd like to meet and shake hands with. A bell has all the personality of a cast iron skillet. It's like saying that come Christmas, a magic dustpan flies in from the North Pole, led by 8 flying cinder blocks. And who wants to stay up all night so they can see a bell? And why fly one in from Rome when they've got more bells than they know what to do with right here in Paris? That's the most implausible aspect of the whole story, as there's no way the bells of France would allow a foreign worker to fly in and take their jobs. That Roman bell would be lucky to get work cleaning up after a French bell's dog. And even then, he'd need papers. It just didn't add up. Nothing we said was of any help to the Moroccan student. A dead man with long hair supposedly living with her father? A leg of lamb served with palm fronds and chocolate? Equally confused and disgusted, she shrugged her massive shoulders and turned her attention back to the comic book she kept hidden beneath her binder. I wondered then, If without the language barrier, my classmates and I could have done a better job making sense of Christianity, an idea that sounds pretty far-fetched to begin with. In communicating any religious belief, the operative word is faith, a concept illustrated by our very presence in that classroom. Why bother struggling with the grammar lessons of a 6-year-old if each of us didn't believe that against all reason, we might eventually improve? If I could hope one day to carry on a fluent conversation, it was a relatively short leap to believing that a rabbit might visit my home in the middle of the night, leaving behind a handful of chocolate kisses and a carton of menthol cigarettes. So why stop there? If I could believe in myself, why not give other improbabilities the benefit of the doubt? I told myself that despite her past behavior, my teacher was a kind and loving person who had only my best interests at heart. I accepted the idea that an omniscient God had cast me in his own image and that he watched over me and guided me from one place to the next. The virgin birth, the resurrection, and the countless miracles. My heart expanded to encompass all the wonders and possibilities of the universe. A Belvo. That's f***ed up.
Jesus Shaves by David Sedaris, read by Tim Blake Nelson. Many of these stories have magical elements, a theme we've explored on our new selected short CD, A Touch of Magic. You can find more information about the CD set at selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Support for this program also comes from Bas Bleu, a source of an eclectic mix of books and gifts for readers, online at basbleu.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.